Fleet flinched at the naked emotion that was so rare among the freemen. Dominic's distant gaze was only partly focused on the bejeweled map on the wall. Somewhere in Imperial records, undoubtedly covered with dust, is the name of the renegade family that used forbidden atomics to devastate a continent here. Leet shuddered. What were they thinking? Why would even a renegade do such a terrible thing?
They did what they had to do, Weichi, Jodem snapped, rubbing the scar on his eyebrow. We cannot know the price of their desperation.
Dominic sagged deeper into his chair. Some Carinos, damn them and their descendants, were left alive. The surviving emperor, Hasik III, moved his capital to Kaitain. And the Imperium goes on. The Carinos go on. And they took an ironic pleasure in turning the hellhole of Seleucus Secundus into their private prison world. Every member of that renegade family was hunted down and brought here to suffer horrible deaths. The bristly-haired veteran, Asuyo, nodded gravely. It's said that their ghosts still haunt this place, eh? Startled, Leet recognized that the exiled Earl Vernius saw reminders of himself in that desperate, long-forgotten family. Though Dominic seemed good-natured, Leet had learned the depths of pain this man had endured. His wife murdered, his subjects crushed under a Tleilaxu yoke, his son and daughter forced to live in exile on Caladan. Those renegades long ago, Dominic said with a strange light in his eyes. They weren't as thorough as I'd have been with the killing. A duke must always take control of his household, for if he does not rule those closest to him, he cannot hope to govern a planet. Duke Paulus Atreides. Shortly after the noonday meal, Leto sat on the carpeted floor of the playroom, bouncing his 4.5-year-old son on his knee. Though he had grown big for the game, Victor still squealed with unbounded glee. Through Armor Plaza windows, the Duke could see the blue Caladan sky kissing the sea at the horizon, with white clouds scudding above. Behind him, Kylia watched from the doorway.
He's too old for that, Leto. Stop treating him like a baby.
Victor doesn't seem to agree. He bounced the dark-haired boy even higher, eliciting louder giggles. Leto's relationship with Kylia had improved in the 6 months since he'd installed the fabulously expensive blue obsidian walls. Now the dining hall and Kylia's private tower chambers echoed the splendor of the Grand Palais. But her mood had darkened again in recent weeks, as she brooded, no doubt egged on by Kiara, over how much time he spent with Jessica. Leto no longer paid any attention to her complaints. They ran off him like spring rain. In sharp contrast, Jessica demanded nothing from him. Her kindness and occasional suggestions energized him, and allowed him to perform his duties as Duke with compassion and fairness. For Kylia's sake, and for Victor's as well, Leto would not harm her reputation on Caladan. The people loved their Duke, and he let them maintain their illusions of fairy-tale happiness in his castle, much the same way Paulus had feigned a pleasant marriage with Lady Helena. The old Duke had called it bedroom politics, the bane of leaders all across the Imperium.
"Oh, why do I make the effort to talk with you at all, Leto?" Kylia said, still standing at the playroom doorway. "It's like arguing with a stone."
Leto stopped bouncing Victor and looked over at her, his gray eyes hard. He kept his voice carefully neutral. "I didn't realize you were making much of an effort." Muttering an insult under her breath, Kylia whirled and stalked down the corridor. Leto pretended not to notice she had left. Spying her blond-haired brother carrying a balisset over one shoulder, Kylia hurried to catch up with him. But upon seeing her, Romber just shook his head.
He held up a wide hand to forestall what he knew would be a flood of complaints.
"What is it now, Kylia?"
He touched one hand to the balisette strings.
Zufir Hawat had continued teaching him how to play the nine-stringed instrument.
"Have you found something new to be angry about, or is it a subject I've heard before?"
His tone took her aback.
"Is that any way to greet your sister? You've been avoiding me for days."
Her emerald eyes flashed.
"Because all you do is complain. Leto won't marry you. He plays too rough with Victor. He spends too much time with Jessica. He should take you to Kaitain more often. He doesn't use his napkin right. I'm tired of trying to mediate between you two."
He shook his head.
"To top it all off, it seems to irritate you that I'm completely content with Tesha. Stop blaming everyone else, Kylia. Your happiness is your own responsibility."
"I've lost too much in my life to be happy." She raised her chin. Now Romber actually looked angry.
"Are you really too self-centered to see that I've lost as much as you have? I just don't let it eat at me every day."
"But we didn't have to lose it. You can still do more for House Vernius."
She was ashamed of his ineffectiveness.
"I'm glad our parents aren't here to see this. You're a pitiful excuse for a prince, brother."
"Now, that does sound a little like Tesha, though the way she says it isn't so grating."
She fell silent as Jessica emerged from a passageway and turned toward the playroom. Kylia flashed the other concubine a dagger glare, but Jessica smiled congenially. After entering the playroom to join Leto and Victor, she closed the door behind her. Looking back at Romber, Kylia snapped,
"My son Victor is the future and hope of a new House Atreides, but you can't understand that simple fact."
The Ixian prince just shook his head, deeply saddened.
"I try to be pleasant to her, but it's no use," Jessica said, inside the playroom. "She hardly says a word to me, and the way she looks at—"
"Not again."
Leto heaved a perturbed sigh. "I know Kylia's causing damage to my family, but I can't find it in my heart to just send her away."
He sat on the floor while his son played with toy ground cars and ornithopters.
"If it weren't for Victor—"
"Kiara is always whispering something to her. The results are obvious. Kylia is a powder keg ready to explode."
Holding a model thopter in his hands, Duke Leto looked up at Jessica helplessly.
"Now you're showing spite of your own, Jessica. I'm disappointed in you."
His face hardened.
"Concubines do not rule this house."
Because he knew Jessica had spent years in Bene Gesserit training, Leto was surprised to see all color drain from her face.
"My lord, I didn't mean it that way. I'm so sorry."
Bowing, she backed up and left the room. Leto stared blankly at the toy, then at Victor. He felt completely lost. A short while later, concealed like a shadow, Jessica observed Kylia in the castle foyer, whispering to Swain Guar, the household guard who spent much of his time watching over Victor. Guar's loyalty and dedication to the Duke had always been clear, and Jessica had seen how much he adored his young ward. Guar seemed uneasy about receiving so much attention from the ducal concubine. Seemingly by accident, Kylia brushed her breasts against his arm, but he pulled away. Having been schooled in the intricate ways of human nature by the Bene Gesserit, Jessica was only surprised that Kylia had taken so long to attempt this petty revenge against Leto. 2 nights later, unnoticed even by Thufir Hawat, Kylia slipped quietly into Guar's bedroom. We create our own future by our own beliefs, which control our actions. A strong enough belief system, a sufficiently powerful conviction, can make anything happen. This is how we create our consensus reality, including our gods. Reverend Mother Romalo, Sayyidina of the Freemen. The Swordmaster Practice Hall on the New Guinea's Island was so opulent that it would not have been out of place in any Landsrad ruling seat or even in the Imperial Palace on Kitane. When Duncan Idaho stepped onto the gleaming hardwood floor, a veneer of light and dark strips laid down and polished by hand, he looked around in wonder. A dozen reflected images stared back at him from beveled floor-to-ceiling mirrors, bounded by intricately wrought gold frames. It had been 7 years since he'd seen surroundings this fine, in Castle Caladan, where he'd trained under Thufir Hawat in the Atreides Hall. Wind-bowed cypress trees surrounded the magnificent training facility on three sides, with a stony beach on the fourth. The ostentatious building was startling in its stark contrast with the students' primitive barracks. Run by Swordmaster Whitmore Blood, a balding man with a purple birthmark on his forehead, the ornamentation of this practice hall would have made shaggy-haired Mord Kur laugh. Though an accomplished duelist, foppish Blood considered himself a noble and surrounded himself with fine things, even on his remote Guinea's Island. Blessed with an inexhaustible family fortune, Blood had spent his own money to make this fencing facility the most civilized place in the entire archipelago. The Swordmaster was a direct descendant of Porse Blood, who had fought valiantly in the Butlerian Jihad. Prior to the battle exploits that had bought him fame and cost him his life, Porse Blood transported war-orphaned children to sanctuary planets, paying the tremendous costs out of his huge inheritance. On Guinea's, Whitmore Blood never forgot his heritage, or allowed others to forget either. As Duncan stood with the others in the echoing hall, smelling lemon and carnauba oil, seeing splinters of light from chandeliers and mirrors, the finery seemed foreign to him. Paintings of dour-looking blood noblemen lined the walls. A massive fireplace befitting a royal hunting lodge reached to the ceiling. A fully stocked armory held racks of swords and fencing paraphernalia. The palatial decor implied an army of servants. But Duncan saw no other souls besides the trainees, the assistant instructors, and Whitmore Blood himself. After permitting the students to gape in astonishment and uncertainty, Swordmaster Blood strutted in front of them. He wore billowy lavender pantaloons bound at the knees, and gray hose down to short black boots. The belt was wide, with a square buckle the size of his hand. His blouse shirt had a high restrictive collar, long ballooning sleeves, tight cuffs, and lace trimmings. "I will teach you fencing, monsieur," he said. "No brutish nonsense with body shields and kinjal daggers and power packs. No, most vehemently no." He withdrew a whip-thin blade with a bell-shaped handguard and a triangular cross-section. He swished it in the air. "Fencing is the sport, no, the art of swordsmanship with a blunted blade. It is a dance of mental reflexes, as well as of the body." He thrust the flexible épée into a scabbard at his side, then ordered all of the students to change into fancy fencing outfits. Archaic musketeer costumes with studded buttons, lacy cuffs, ruffles, and cumbersome billows. "The better to display the beauty of fencing," Blood said. By now Duncan had learned never to hesitate in following instructions. He pulled on knee-high calfskin boots with cavalier spurs, and slipped into a blue velvet short coat with a lace collar and voluminous white sleeves. He donned a rakish broad-brimmed felt hat with the variegated pink plume of a paella peacock tucked into its band. Across the room he and he Resser made eyes and faces at each other, amused. The attire seemed better suited to a holiday mask than to fighting. "You will learn to fight with finesse and grace, monsieur." Whitmore Blood strutted back and forth,
immensely pleased with all the finery around him. "You will see the artistry in a fine duel. You will turn every movement into an art form."
The foppish but powerfully built swordmaster picked at a speck of lint on his ruffled shirt.
"With only a year left in your training, one assumes you have the potential to rise above animal attacks and cloddish brawls. We will not lower ourselves to barbarism here."
Morning sunlight passed through a high, narrow window and glinted off Duncan's pewter buttons. Feeling foolish, he examined himself in the wall mirror, then found his usual place in formation. When the remaining students lined up on the hardwood practice floor, Swordmaster Blood inspected their uniforms with many sighs and disapproving noises. He smoothed wrinkles, while scolding the young men for incorrectly buttoned cuffs and criticizing their attire with surprising seriousness.
"Terran musketeer fencing is the 15th fighting discipline you will learn. But knowing the moves does not mean you understand the style. Today you will compete against one another with all the grace and chivalry that fencing demands. Your epees will not be blunted, and you will wear no protective masks."
He indicated racks of fencing swords between each bank of mirrors on the wall, and the students moved forward to arm themselves. All the blades were identical, 90 centimeters long, flexible, and sharp. The students toyed with them. Duncan wished he could use the old Duke sword, but the fabulously tooled weapon was made for a different kind of fighting, not fencing. Blood sniffed, then swished his thin épée in the air to recapture their attention.
"You must fight to your fullest ability, but I insist that there be no injuries or blood on either opponent. Not so much as a scratch. No, most vehemently no. And certainly no damage to the clothes. Learn the perfect attack and the perfect defense. Lunge, parry, riposte. Practice supreme control. You are each responsible for your fellows."
He swept his ice-blue gaze across the trainees, and his birthmark darkened on his forehead.
"Any man who fails me, anyone who causes a wound or allows himself to be injured, will be disqualified from the next sequence of competitions."
Duncan drew deep, calming breaths, centering himself to face the challenge.
"This is a test of your artistry, monsieur," Blood said, pacing the polished floor in his black boots. "This is the delicate dance of personal combat. The goal will be to score touches upon your opponent's person without cutting him."
The spotlessly clean swordmaster picked up his feathered hat and set it firmly on his head. He indicated marked combat rectangles inlaid into the beautiful parquet floor.
"Prepare to fight."
Duncan quickly defeated three comparatively easy opponents, but his fourth adversary, Is Opru, a smooth stylist from Al-Danab, made himself a difficult target. Even so, the dark-skinned Opru had insufficient skill in offense to match his defense, and Duncan outscored him by a single point. In a nearby combat box, a student buckled at the knees and bled from a wound in his side. The assistant trainers rushed in and removed him on a litter. His opponent, a Tarazi with shoulder-length hair, scowled at his stained blade, awaiting his punishment. Whitmore Blood snagged the Tarazi student's sword and viciously flogged his backside with it, as if it were a metal whip.
"Both of you are a disgrace to your training. Him for allowing the wound, you for not exercising sufficient restraint."
Without protest, the Tarazi stumbled to the loser's bench. Now two liveried servants, the first Duncan had seen, rushed in to clean up the blood and polish the parquet in preparation for the next match. The fighting continued. Duncan Idaho, along with Resser and two other perspiring finalists, stood panting in the center of the practice hall, awaiting their final dueling assignments. Frustrated and uncomfortable, they had come to loathe their extravagant costumes. But so far, none of the finalists had been scratched. None of the heavy fabric had been torn.
"Idaho and Resser over here. Edin and Alcaba there. Swordmaster Blood called out, designating combat rectangles on the floor. Obediently, the students moved into position. Resser eyed Duncan, sizing him up as a foe instead of as a friend. Duncan crouched, flexing his knees and balancing on the balls of his feet. Leaning forward with his arm slightly bent, he extended the épée toward Resser, then drew back in a brief salute. With a confident look, the red-headed Grumman did the same. Evenly matched, they had dueled one another many times in full protective gear, with other weapons. Duncan's speed usually compensated for lanky Resser's superior height and reach. But now they had to follow Blood's rules of fencing, inflict or receive no scratches, not even damage the expensive, anachronistic outfits. Bouncing on his feet to stay loose, Duncan said nothing. The flexible sword would do the talking for him. Perspiration prickled his black hair beneath the felt hat and the distracting peacock plume. He stared up at his freckled opponent. "En garde!" Blood said. His blue eyes flashed as he raised his blade. At the signal to begin, Resser lunged forward. Duncan parried, deflecting his opponent's blade with a sound like singing chimes, then took half a step to the right and delivered a precise riposte, skillfully diverted by the tall Grumman. Swords clattered together, steel skimming steel, as the two felt each other out. Both men were sweating, panting, their expressions fading into blank stares as they moved back and forth within the clear boundaries of dark wood on the parquet floor. So far, Resser had done nothing unexpected, as usual. Duncan hoped he could use that trait to defeat his opponent. As if sensing the direction of his friend's thoughts, the redhead began to fight with the fury of a warrior possessed, scoring one touché on Duncan, and then two, careful not to damage his opponent, but also relying on Duncan to mount a perfect defense. Duncan had never seen such energy in his friend, and he struggled to elude a series of vicious thrusts. He backed up, waiting for the flurry of activity to ebb. Sweat ran down his cheek. Still, Resser pressed on at a frantic pace, as if under the influence of a stimulant. Their swords clattered loudly. Duncan could spare no fraction of his attention to note the progress of the other match, but heard shouting and a final clang of blades that told him the two other contestants had finished. Swordmaster Blood gave Duncan's match the full weight of his scrutiny. The redhead's point touched him on his padded shirt, then seconds later on the forehead. Resser was scoring points, leaving no scratches, following the rules. 4 points now, and with 5 he would win the match. If this had been a fight to the death, I would be dead now. Like a carrion bird waiting for a feast, Blood watched every move. Under Resser's onslaught, Duncan's muscles seemed to be slowing, holding him back and preventing him from applying his normal skills. He looked at the épée in his right hand and dredged up resources and strength within himself, drawing upon everything he had learned in 7 years on Ginaz. "I fight for House Atreides. I can win." Resser danced deftly around him with the épée, making him look foolish. Duncan's breathing slowed, and his heart rate diminished. "Maximize chi," he thought, visualizing the energy that flowed along precise paths in his body. "I must become a complete swordmaster to defend my duke, not make a pretty performance to please these instructors." Resser ceased scoring as Duncan danced away. The chi within him mounted, building pressure, waiting for the right moment to be released. Duncan focused the energy, aiming it. Now he was on the attack. He confused the lanky redhead with moves synthesized from various fighting disciplines. He whirled, kicked, used his free hand as a weapon. They both staggered outside the boundaries of the fencing area, then back into the rectangle. Duncan attacked again. A fist to the side of Resser's head, knocking off the feathered cap, a kick to the stomach, all without drawing blood. Stunned, Resser thudded to the floor. Duncan knocked his rival's sword away and leaped on top of him, placing the tip of his own blade at the Grumman's throat. "Victory!" "Gods below, what are you doing?" Swordmaster Blood shoved Duncan off Resser. You clod!
He grabbed the flexible sword away and slapped Duncan twice across the face.
This isn't a street brawl, fool! We're doing musketeer fencing today. Are you an animal?
Duncan rubbed his face where he'd been struck. In the heat of combat, he had fought for survival, ignoring the frivolous restrictions imposed by the instructor. Blood slapped Duncan several more times, harder each time, as if the student had personally insulted him. In the background, Resser kept saying,
"It's all right. I'm not hurt. He bested me and I couldn't defend myself."
Humiliated, Duncan backed away. Blood's rage did not subside.
"You may think you're the best student in the class, Idaho, but you're a failure in my eyes."
Duncan felt like a small child being backed into a corner by an adult with a strap. He wanted to fight back, wanted to stand up to this ridiculous-looking man, but didn't dare. He recalled the ill-tempered Trin Kronos using the same reasoning with fat swordmaster Rivi Denari. "If you are bound by nonsensical strictures, you'll be beaten by any opponent willing to bend the rules." His primary purpose was to defend his duke against any possible threat, not to play fencing games in costumes.
"Think about why you're a failure," Whitmore Blood thundered, "and then explain it to me."
"Tell that to the dead soldiers on the losing side." Duncan thought hard. He did not want to echo the shameful thinking of the spoiled Kronos, though it made more sense than he had realized before. Rules could be interpreted differently, depending on the purpose they served. In some situations, there was no absolute good or evil, simply points of view. In any event, he knew what his instructor wanted to hear. "I am a failure because my mind is imperfect." His answer seemed to surprise the muscular man, but a bemused smile gradually formed on Blood's face.
"Correct enough, Idaho," he said. "Now get over there with the other losers."
Challenge. Time? Answer. A brilliant, many-faceted gem. Challenge. Time? Answer. A dark stone, reflecting no visible light. Freeman Wisdom, from The Riddle Game. With his balisette slung by a leather strap over one shoulder, Romber Vernius hiked down the steep, zigzag trail to the bottom of the black cliff. Castle Caladan loomed high over the rock face, stretching toward the billowing cumulus clouds and the cerulean sky. A strong early afternoon breeze caressed his face. Behind him, in one of those soaring castle towers, his sister spent too much time brooding. As he paused to look back, he saw Kailia up there now, standing on her balcony. With forced cheer, he waved to her, but she did not respond. For months, they had hardly spoken to one another. This time he shook his head and decided not to let her usual rebuff bother him. His sister's expectations outweighed her reality. It was a warm spring day with gray gulls soaring on thermals over the whitecaps. Like one of the poor village fishermen, Romber wore a short-sleeved blue and white-striped shirt, fishing dungarees, and a blue cap jammed over his blonde hair. Tesha sometimes walked along the shore with him, while other times she let him ponder by himself. With Kailia's dark moods in mind, the Ixian prince descended a wooden stairway that cantilevered out over the cliff. He took care on the rough, moss-covered section of trail. It was a treacherous route, even in good weather. A careless misstep, and he could tumble to the rocks below. Hardy green shrubs clung to crevices on the sheer rock face, along with orange and yellow succulents. Duke Leto, like his father before him, preferred to leave the path essentially natural, with minimal maintenance. "The life of a leader should not be too soft," the Atreides men liked to say. Rather than discussing his concerns with Tesha,
Romber decided to soothe his troubled spirits by spending time on a small boat, drifting alone and playing the balisette. Not confident of his musical abilities, he preferred to practice away from the castle anyway, where no critical ears could hear him. After traversing a black shingle downslope to the main dock, he took a steep wooden stairway down to a finger pier where a white motorboat bobbed gently in the waves. A purple and copper Ixion insignia marked the bow above letters that named the craft after his missing father, Dominic. Each time Romber saw the name, he dreamed that his father might still be alive, somewhere in the Imperium. The Earl of House Vernius had disappeared, and with the passage of time all hope of locating him had faded. Dominic had never sent word, made no contact at all. He must be dead. Romber unslung the balisette and laid the instrument on the dock. A cleat on the stern of the boat was missing one bolt, so he climbed aboard and opened a toolbox in the cockpit, where he found another bolt and a ratchet to tighten it down. He liked to maintain his own boat, and sometimes hours would pass as he worked on it, sanding, painting, lacquering, replacing hardware, installing new electronics and fishing accessories. It was all so different from the pampered life he'd led on Ix. Now, as he stepped back onto the dock and made the simple repair, Romber wished he could be the leader that his father had been. The chances of that seemed virtually nil. Though Romber had made efforts to help the mysterious rebels on Ix, he hadn't heard from them in over a year, and some of the weapons and explosives he'd sent had come back undelivered, despite bribes paid to transport workers. Even the most highly paid smugglers had been unable to infiltrate the material into the cavernous underground city. No one knew what was going on there. Kater Pilru, his primary contact with the freedom fighters, had fallen silent. Like Dominic himself, Kater might be dead, the valiant struggle crushed with him. Romber had no way of knowing, no means of breaching the intense Tleilaxu security. Hearing footsteps on the dock, Romber was surprised to see his sister approaching. Kylea wore a showy dress of silver and gold. A ruby clasp secured her copper dark hair. He noticed that both of her shins were red and bruised, and that the hem of her dress was soiled. "I tripped on the trail," she admitted. She must have run after him, hurrying to catch up. "You don't often come down to the docks," he forced a smile. "Would you like to go out on the boat with me?" When Kylea shook her head, her curls bounced against her cheeks. "I'm here to apologize, Romber. I'm sorry I've been so mean to you, avoiding you, hardly saying anything at all." "And glaring at me," he added. Her emerald eyes flashed before she caught herself and softened. "That too." "Apology accepted." He finished tightening down the cleat, then climbed back into the cockpit of the Dominic to put the tools away. She remained on the dock after he stepped aboard. "Romber," Kylea began in a plaintive tone that was only too familiar. It meant she wanted something, though her face was all innocence. "You and Tessia are so close. I just wish I had the same relationship with Leto."
"Relationships require maintenance," he said. "Like this boat. With some time and care, you could repair things between you two."
Her mouth twisted in a grimace of distaste. "But isn't there anything more you can do about Leto? We can't go on this way forever."
"Do about him? It sounds like you want to dispose of him."
His sister did not answer directly. "Victor should be his legal heir, not a bastard without name, title, or property. There must be something different you can say to Leto, something more you could try." "Vermilion hells, Kylea, I've tried 50 different times and 50 different ways, and he always turns me down.
It's already driven a wedge between us. Because of you, I may have lost my best friend.
The glow of sunshine on her skin looked like distant firelight.
What does mere friendship matter when we're talking about the future of House Vernius, the great house of our forefathers? Think about the important things, Romber.
His expression turned to stone. You've turned this into a problem, when it never had to be. You alone, Kylea. If you couldn't accept the limitations, why did you agree to become Leto's concubine at all?
You two seemed so happy at first. Why don't you apologize to him? Why not simply accept reality? Why don't you make an effort?
Romber shook his head, stared at the fire jewel ring on his right hand. I'm not going to question Leto's decisions. I may not agree with his reasons, but I understand them. He is Duke Atreides, and we owe him the respect of following his wishes. Kylea's expression, which she had been keeping under control, changed to a disdainful sneer.
You're not a prince. Kiara says you're not even a man.
She lifted one foot and stomped at the balisette, but in her rage lost her balance and dealt it only a glancing blow. The instrument skidded off the dock into the water, where it floated behind the boat. Swearing, Romber leaned out over the edge of the dock and retrieved the balisette, as Kylea whirled and left. While drying the instrument with a towel, he watched her climb the steep path back to the castle, half running and half walking. She stumbled, got back up, and kept going, trying to maintain her dignity. No wonder Leto preferred the calm, intelligent Jessica. Kylea, once so sweet and kind, had become hard and cruel. He didn't know her anymore. He sighed. I love her, but I don't like her. It requires a desperate and lonely sort of courage to challenge the accepted wisdom upon which social peace of mind rests. Crown Prince Rafael Corino, in defense of change in the face of tradition. The towering government buildings of Corinth, the capital city of Kytane, rose around Abelard Harkonnen like a drug-induced fantasy. In his wildest dreams, he had never visualized so many soaring edifices, jeweled inlays, and polished slabs of precious stone. On Gedi Prime, where he'd grown up under the watchful eye of his father Dimitri, cities were crowded, with dirty settlements erected for function and industry rather than beauty. But here it was quite different. Colorful chime kites were tethered to the tall buildings, writhing on breezes in the perpetually blue skies. Prismatic ribbons drifted across the sky and shed rainbows on the flagstones below. Kytane was obviously more concerned with form than substance. Within an hour, the sunny dazzle of perfect skies made Abelard dizzy, causing an ache in the back of his skull. He longed for the overcast skies of Lankavile, the damp breezes that cut right to the bone, and the warm embrace of Emmy. But Abelard had an important task to perform, an appointment at the daily Landsrad Council meeting. It seemed a mere formality, but he was determined to do it, for the sake of his family and his infant son, and it would change his life forever. Abelard longed for the days to come. He strode along the promenade under banners of great and minor houses that flapped precisely in the gentle winds. The imposing buildings seemed even more massive and powerful than the cliffs bounding the fjords of Lankavile. He had taken care to wear his grandest whale fur cloak adorned with precious jewels and hand-worked scrimshaw amulets. Abelard had come to Corinth as a legal representative of House Harkonnen to reclaim his title as sub-district governor of Rabban Lankavile. It had always been his right, but never before had it mattered to him. Because he walked without an escort or a retinue of sycophants, the clerks and functionaries dismissed Abelard as not deserving of notice.
They looked out the windows, sat on balconies, or bustled to and fro with important documents scribed on Redoulian crystal sheets. To them he was invisible. When seeing him off at the Lankaville spaceport, Emmy had coached him, making him rehearse for her. According to the rules of the Landsrad, Abelard had the authority to request an audience and to file his documents. The other nobles would see his request as minor, trivial even, but it meant so much to him, and he had put it off for too long. During the months of Emmy's pregnancy, happy again, they had reopened the main lodge and tried to bring life and color back into their lives. Abelard subsidized industries, even seeded the waters with fish so that boatmen could earn a livelihood until the Beyondex whales chose to return. Then, 5 months ago, Emmy had quietly given birth to a healthy baby boy. They named him Fade Rautha, partly in honor of his grandfather, Onir Rautha Rabban, the slain burgomaster of Bifrost Erie. When Abelard held the baby in his arms, he saw quick, intelligent eyes, and an insatiable curiosity, exquisite features, and a strong voice. In his heart, this was now his only son. Together he and Emmy had searched for the old Buddhist-Islamic monk who had been responsible for the pregnancy. They wanted to thank her and have her bless the healthy infant, but they could find no trace of the wizened woman in sky-blue robes and gold embroidery. Now, on Kytane, Abelard would do something to benefit his new son, more than a simple monk's blessing could ever accomplish. If it went well, little Fade Rautha would have a different future, untainted by the crimes in House Harkonnen's extended history. He would grow up to be a good man. Standing tall, Abelard entered the Landsrad Hall of Oratory, passing beneath a mottled coral archwork that rose over his head like a bridge across a mountain chasm. Upon arriving at the capital world, he had made an appointment with an imperial scribe to add his name to the agenda. When Abelard refused to bribe the functionary, though, the scheduling secretary was unable to find a slot open until the end of a long session, 3 days hence. So Abelard had waited. He despised bureaucratic corruption and preferred to inconvenience himself rather than bow to the unfortunate standards of Shaddam IV's court. He disliked long-distance travel, would rather have stayed home tending his own affairs or playing board games with Emmy and the household staff. But the requirements of noble status forced him to do many things he came to regret. Perhaps today he would change all that for the better. Within the Hall of Oratory, meetings were held by representatives of the great and minor houses, Chome directors, and other important officials who had no noble titles. The business of the Imperium continued daily. Abelard expected his appearance to draw little attention.